But he made his name once he started publishing the Carolina Israelite newspaper, writing on race relations and equal rights. He wrote about popular Jewish culture in the South at a time when it wasn't popular. It was practically non-existent. He reached tens of thousands of people, including some very big names of the day. His approach to thinking, to explaining positions on some touchy subjects, and his use of humor helped him in gaining popularity and landed him on national TV shows like The Tonight Show. Harry Golden died in 1981, but his writing remains relevant, and now his name is resurfacing thanks to Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett, who has written the first comprehensive biography of the man, Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. And she joins us for the hour. Thank you for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You're in New York today, but you'll actually be in town at Lerner Hall at the Jewish Community Center on May 31st. I believe that's Sunday at 7 p.m. to talk about this and sign some books as well.
Yes, I will.
Your biography describes you as a journalist working for 30-plus years in New England and in the Pacific Northwest. You live now in Portland, Oregon. Why your interest in Harry Golden, and how did you even know about him?
Oh, it's a fair question. Well, I'm the only Yankee in my family ever. My mother was a Charlotte girl, and she worked for Harry Golden as a secretary in the years following World War II. So I grew up reading his work. She was a newspaper publisher in Massachusetts by that time. And I think I started reading him when I was about 10 years old.
Wow. You know, if I'd asked you that question in 1970 or 1968, you would have looked at me like I'd grown three heads, because everybody perhaps would have known about Harry Golden. He'd made the rounds of national talk shows. He appeared on The Tonight Show, as I mentioned. He was interviewed by Edward R. Murrow. He was known by the Kennedys and Adlai Stevenson and Carl Sandburg and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He had a nationally syndicated newspaper column. Is that how he came to the attention of these people, or did he do it another way?
Well, he was phenomenally well known. I was surprised, even when I began the research of this many years ago, to discover how far and how deep his reach was. That had everything to do with Harry being a phenomenal self-promoter. And bear in mind, this was all pre-internet.
Right.
But he was very clever. He had a gift for the clever one-liner. Every reporter of any consequence in the country had Harry's name in his or her Rolodex, and on a slow news day, they knew who to call. And he had a particular trick where he would take the name of a very famous person and list them in the Carolina Israelite as a dedicated and regular subscriber. And it was amazing. It often worked. Not only did they then really subscribe, but they became friends.
So he put their names on the list as subscribers, even though they weren't. Did he
send Absolutely.
Them? Did he send them copies of the paper as well?
He did, and there's people love free stuff. Some things never change. He was just such a brazen character in that way that even as he was irritating many people, he was amusing them too, and he formed a lot of genuine friendships that
way.
Was
he doing putting people's name on the subscriber list even though they weren't subscribers? Was he doing this before he was famous or after he became famous? So when people got the newspaper and saw themselves on the subscriber list, they thought, okay, well, it's Harry Golden, for crying out loud. What the heck?
Oh, that's a very good question, because, yes, he did start it when he was a nobody. He started the paper in the early 40s, and, no branding expert in the world now would say, Carolina Israelite, what a great name for a newspaper. But it started with, some backing of very prominent Jewish business people in Charlotte who had great interest in an interfaith newspaper. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was initially. And then, Harry pretty quickly turned it into his voice and his baby. But long before he was well known, he was pulling the fake subscriber thing. And, you know, there's nothing like a celebrity endorsement.
You know, it was 1941. It was Charlotte, North Carolina. This is not exactly a bastion of Judaism today, but it more so today than in 1941, heavens knows. And that's in part, I suppose, because of Harry Golden and many other people. But calling your newspaper the Carolina Israelite, putting a menorah and the Torah on the masthead, why did he do that? If he wanted to make inroads into this community at that time, why did he do it that way?
Well, I think it really did have a lot to do with the backing at the time. And one of his major backers was I.D. Blumenthal, whose name, of course, is still very well known as a very generous philanthropist in Charlotte, mm-hmm. and Arthur Goodman, and these leading members of the Jewish community essentially helped fund this initial effort, and they really wanted a, for lack of a better term, an ecumenical newspaper, which the masthead certainly reflected. And also bear in mind, this is as the, you know, as you said, the situation was changing. It was a way to educate Gentile community about the Jewish population and the many good things that were going on in their communities and synagogues and so forth. You know, I think Harry was very much an opportunist, and so he had this chance to open the doors on a little publication, and that's how they started it. It did very quickly, by the end of the 40s, was very much his voice and less about synagogue news and what the local rabbi had to say and more about his evolving views of the South, particularly the race question.
I was going to ask you next how that began, because you said that the Carolina Israelite began as an interfaith newspaper, but you described him as a writer, a humorist, a fearless advocate for civil rights, also ahead of his time in that arena as well. When did the shift take place? Why did the shift take place?
Well, Harry used to tell the story that he went to the South from his Lower East Side roots and Wall Street roots. You know, he grew up as an immigrant on the Lower East Side, got into some trouble on Wall Street, actually did some prison time, and really left New York to leave that behind and landed in Charlotte. But he used to tell the story that he did this in order to write about civil rights. That is not true. He did this really on the lam. And his initial newspaper relationship in Charlotte was with something called the Charlotte Labor Journal and Dixie Farm News, believe it or not, which is on microfilm, should you ever wish to read the whole thing. After he got there, it was a bit of a culture shock for him, as you might imagine. He used to say, "I arrive in Charlotte. I'm a nobody. I'm a newcomer from up north, and black men whose families have lived in Charlotte for generations would step off the sidewalk to let me pass." So this was a revelation to him. He was not coming from a segregated society in quite the same way. So it caught his interest. And then I think over time, as he realized how much attention he got by talking about the issue, he chose to do more of it, and gradually it became a very real issue to him, but it did not necessarily start out as his reason for being in Charlotte and in the South.
Let's talk about why he was – where he came from and why he was here. I've read that he gave various birth dates over the years, but the figure that I have is that he was born in about 1903, moved with his family from what is now Ukraine in 1907. And they all settled on New York's Lower East Side. That's a very rough and tumble time on the Lower East Side, it seems to me, if my history comes back to me correctly. What was his early life like? What did his parents do? They were immigrants.
They were, and he was about three when he came over. His name was Chaim Goldhirsch at that point. He did have several name changes, but he became Harry Golden when he went to the South. His mother was a traditional Jewish mother of the time who did everything and anything to keep her relatively large family together. His father, he used to call a status wanderer. And what he meant by that was he was a well-educated man, respected in his community, who pretty much refused to do any work that he felt was beneath him, and therefore refused to buy into the American notion that, you know, you work your way up and take whatever laboring job you can get when you arrive on the shores of America. So He was a teacher. He was a talker. He was an arguer. He was often referred to as Reb. He was not literally a rabbi, but he was a learned man. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Harry grew up very much influenced by his parents. He was a very hard worker, but he was really a professional arguer, just like his father, and that's where he learned it. And he was obviously very much identified as a Jew, but he was not particularly religious. He was what we would now call more of a secular or cultural Jew. Mm.
Now, as you say, his father kind of refused not to assimilate, but to buy into how Americans get ahead. He didn't choose to take that path. But his children evidently did, because his daughter, his Harry Golden sister, had her own firm on Wall Street during the Roaring Twenties, which was the heyday of the stock market prior to the crash of the market in 1929. And he also gravitated toward Wall Street. You call him a bit of a con man. He was arrested and jailed in his young adulthood for investment fraud during the Great Depression or prior to the Great Depression. What exactly did he do?
Well, he ran something which was called a bucket shop. And at its simplest, what that means is if I run one of those, I take your money to buy stock. And if you think the stock is going to cost $10, I might sit around and wait until it goes to $8, and then I can pocket $2. Well, Harry did this on a very grand scale, and that worked very well until the broker bet incorrectly. The other thing he did, and this is how he got convicted, is he created something called the partial payment plan. So what that meant was you gave him money to buy stocks, and you didn't really own them until you finished your payment plan.
Hmm.
Which, of course, would be illegal now. But really, lots of people were doing what he was doing.
Okay.
He got caught because he had a very famous client who had a lot of enemies. And his client was Bishop James Cannon, who was a very prominent prohibitionist. And he had some enemies in Congress, including one Virginia Senator, Carter Glass, who really wanted the bishop to come down. And when he discovered he was a huge stock speculator, you know, that gave them the in they wanted there, and Harry got sort of caught in the crossfire.
And he went to prison for how many years?
He did. He got a 5-year prison term, which is the maximum you could get at that time for that kind of federal crime, and he served close to 3 years, I believe, and, you know, for good behavior. But and the story was that he ran the prison library part of the time that he was locked up.
How did that shape the man he would become?
Well, I think that's a very good question because it really did have a big effect on him. You know, he used to say that he grew up in a time of great headlines, and a lot of what he read growing up had an activist flavor to it in the newspapers, and he was a newspaper boy. So he grew up reading about, you know, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and how regulation of workplaces and things sort of grew out of that. And then prison added a layer to that, which is, from that point forward, I think he always had a soft spot for the underdog and for people who, you know, made one big mistake.
And we'll talk about what that led to when he came to Charlotte in more detail in a moment or two. Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett, our guest, she's the biographer of Harry Golden. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina 529 College Savings Plan, helping parents and grandparents save for college education with tax benefits and investment options. NC529.org. Well, drones have moved from combat zones into the civilian arena, and here in our state, our skies are so filled with them, evidently, that the governor, Governor McCrory, and the legislature have put together legislation which the governor has signed to regulate the use of unmanned aircraft systems. Now, these drones have a lot of peaceful applications, but their use requires that some questions be answered, such as who owns the skies and what forms of regulation will be necessary to govern, how they can be used, and by whom. And we'll take a closer look at all of that tomorrow at 9.
I on the next Diane Rehm Show. Texas and Oklahoma passed new laws that prevent local governments from banning hydraulic fracturing. Similar measures are being considered in three other states. Debate over state efforts to regulate drilling.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are remembering Harry Golden today with Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett. She is his biographer. She's written Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About the Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. We'll get to all of that as we go through the program. She will be here on Sunday at Lerner Hall at the Jewish Community Center to speak at 7 p.m., and that is open to the public. And we have information about that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. What brought Harry Golden to Charlotte from New York's Lower East Side?
Well, I think he was looking for a place to land where he could rebuild his life after prison. He moved around the South a bit, sold ads for various smaller newspapers in the region. And he had a strong interest in the labor movement and some connections there from his time in New York. And that took him to the Charlotte Labor Journal and the Dixie Farm News, which is an actual title. I am not making that up. And there he worked for a wonderfully just a great character named Bill Witter, who was the publisher, the well-oiled and often horizontal publisher of the paper. And and he was just a great character, and Golden wrote quite lovingly about him. And that was his sort of launching point, was starting there.
Now, I read that he also worked for the Charlotte Observer. Is that true? And if so, what did he do? Did he write for them? Did he sell ads for them? Or the Charlotte News? I've forgotten which it was now. What is that true?
Yeah, he had relationships with both papers, and my understanding was that he was more often an ad salesperson, and he sold what we would today call advertorial copy, mm-hmm. you know, sort of puff. They called them puffs in those days, and, you know, inserts and so forth.
So they were actually articles, but they were advertising something.
Yeah, for the most part. Now, he did do some writing for the Charlotte papers, but he was never on the staff as what, you know, today we would consider a reporter. He, in fact, was not really a conventional journalist. He played by his own rules, and he was frequently writing about a story of which, you know, he was a main mm-hmm. part.
So he came to the South, and he came to Charlotte ultimately to get a fresh start after his period in prison. Did people know that he had committed fraud on Wall Street and had gone to prison for it?
For the most part, no. He told a couple of people, but that was a very shameful thing at the time. I mean, it would be today, but not to the extent that it was then. So he kept it pretty hush-hush, and it really didn't come out in a big way until his first bestseller, which was a huge and essentially overnight bestseller, very much a surprise even to the publisher, in 58, only in America. Within about 2 months of that coming out, someone sent an anonymous letter to all the major newspapers in New York and said, "You think this guy is so great? Well, he was a jailbird, and he fleeced widows and orphans, and he should be ashamed of himself." And it, you know, Harry thought, that's it. It's all over. But in fact, it just made him a bigger star.
Now, you mentioned that he was he experienced culture shock, as anyone might imagine, coming from the Lower East Side of New York in the 1940s to Charlotte, North Carolina, which was not then what it is today. It was truly a small, small town back then. But somehow he acclimated, and he told audiences later on in life that being a Jew in a small southern town was actually a plus. And here is Harry Golden to explain that comment.
"The best job on this earth, better job than Ben Gurion has, is to be a lone Jew in a small southern town. There's nothing like this nowhere, believe me. The Goyim God, this fellow like the God, the Confederate Monument. They say he's our Jew. He goes to the convention in Chicago, the rotations. We got a fine Jewish family in our town. It's a wonderful job. They name the high school after him. They do anything they want. And he gets in trouble a lot of times. Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians in the South, who are fundamentalists, the Bible Belt, who know the Bible, the Old Testament, as well as the New, by heart. When they have some involved argument in their Sunday school about some biblical passage, they say, "Let's go as Goldstein." They figure this is right out of the horse's mouth. You know? And Goldstein doesn't know what they're talking about.
You call that his style of ecumenical comedy. What does that mean?
Well, he was sort of an equal opportunity satirist or comedian in that he enjoyed making fun of really anybody he could. And I don't think in a mean-spirited way for the most part. But he really enjoyed talking about the difficulties that the Southern Jew had in trying to assimilate and, you know, these awkward moments that were often came from a good place but were undeniably awkward. And that particular clip is one of my favorites for that reason.
Who is he talking to there? Do you know who the audience is?
Yeah, he was actually talking to a Bonds for Israel rally in about 1962 in New York.
You know, I said he appeared on The Tonight Show, and the people of a certain age don't even remember Johnny Carson anymore. But he appeared on The Tonight Show both with Johnny Carson and Johnny's predecessor, Jack Parr. And Jack Parr was particularly known for The Tonight Show and the show that followed, The Jack Parr Show, for inviting raconteurs onto his show, intellectual people who could riff on topics of the day, sometimes very seriously and sometimes like Harry Golden with a great deal of humor, which is something I think is grossly missing on television today. Harry Golden was perfect for that time period, wasn't he?
He was. And, you know, I often wish we had him around today. We could use him with some of the things that are going on. But you raise a good point. You know, Parr, as much as I love Johnny Carson, he was one of my all-time favorites. Mm-hmm. But Parr did do something a little different there. And Golden was much more relaxed and at his best on that particular late-night couch for that reason. He could take something and really run with it. He wasn't just a comedian. He was very well-read. He taught Shakespeare, in fact, in his old age at a community college in Charlotte. And he, when he had a good sparring partner, could be very, very entertaining.
Mm. You say that he grabbed money as a younger person. He grabbed money with both hands during the Roaring Twenties in the stock market. Then he seemed to be on the scene of some of the century's most important events. He was in the right place, almost like Forrest Gump. What was it about his life or his upbringing that made him the champion of the little man? Was it just his time in prison, a preacher against racism, a conscious pricking voice for any number of societal ills? Was it his father and the fact that his father was a thinker? Was it his time in prison? Was it something else?
Well, I think, as is the case with most of us, it's a combination of things. I do think the roots are in his home with two, in very different ways, two very thoughtful parents. I think that the prison time certainly made him aware of how quickly one's life can turn from great promise to, you know, the extreme opposite. I think the South, when he arrived and saw a kind of segregation that he wasn't used to, and I always feel like I need to inject at this point, it's not as if the North was free of segregation by any means. It was just it had a different cloak around it, let's put it that way. It just looks different. But I also think that, you know, the South really welcomed Golden. And I think as much as he could be an irritant, and he was sometimes certainly an embarrassment to the Jewish community, both nationally and locally, for his outspoken and sometimes outrageous comments, people welcomed him as Southerners do. And he made a comfortable home in Charlotte. And I think that sort of freed him up to look around for the first time in his life.
I don't know how much you know about Charlotte, but Charlotte prides itself on welcoming people from everywhere. It's not about who your family is or who your daddy and mommy were and your grandparents, but about what you can bring to us, what contributions you can make. Now, that's what we say. I don't know how true that is, and I don't know how different it would be, say, if he'd settled in Birmingham or if he'd settled in Atlanta. But we seem to say that we're different from those places. Did he find it so? Do you think that's true?
Well, I personally certainly think it's true, and I think that Golden did as well. I think if he had landed in one of the bigger cities that had a more violent period, like Birmingham, for example, during the civil rights movement, he would have never made it. That publication wouldn't have taken off. He would not have been tolerated. So I think he was well aware. And again, it was a happy accident that he landed there. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, Charlotte made him welcome.
You talked about his prison experience giving him a sympathy, giving him empathy for the downtrodden and people who are not as well off as perhaps others. And then he comes to the South and he experiences this situation where African-Americans who had lived here forever would step off the sidewalk to allow him space to pass, the kind of Jim Crow antics that permeated the South at the time. I guess that was a shock to him, even though there was racism in the North, active racism in the North. It was different, as you say, cloaked differently. Did he write about how this struck him when he came here? Was that part of his writings on racism?
He did, and I think that that had a lot to do with his success, because he really, and this is probably my favorite thing about Golden, he was really a connector. He introduced the notion of African Americans, their life and situation, particularly in the South, to a lot of white people who had never given it a thought, and similarly with Jews and Gentiles. So I think his early, perhaps somewhat naive, for lack of a better word, observations about the culture that he got there were, you know, ended up being real teaching moment for readers all across the country.
He also had a similar position. He was the other. He was the Gentile. He was the Jew in a Gentile society. That must have played a role as well.
It did, and he certainly played that up. He was, some people have said, and I think there's some truth to this, you know, he was really a professional Jewish outsider. A lot of what gave him his ability to, you know, be the kind of commentator he was to be that. And I don't mean by that he was a victim or he considered himself one.
He was convinced that racial discrimination was dead weight that pulled the whole country down. Now, this was way before the civil rights movement. This is before World War II. How did he come to that enlightened view?
Well, I would hazard a guess that if you went out on the street and interviewed recent arrivals to the country today, that there would be a similar insight. It's absolutely illogical to think that any group of people can move ahead and have success if they're spending time and energy on any kind of segregation, whether it's racial, class, gender, whatever. It takes up a lot of time and energy, and it doesn't move anything forward.
If you're busy putting people down, you're not working on raising people up.
Exactly.
So, but where did the courage to express that view come from? He's in the South, the racially segregated South, where lynchings were still occurring, where the Ku Klux Klan was still in existence. You know, and he's a Jew from the North. He's a Yankee Jew from the North. Where did the courage to publish these opinions come from?
Well, you know, there's an excellent question I don't have a simple answer for, and no one who knew him well, including his son Richard, who I just actually hand-delivered his book to in Westport, Connecticut yesterday. Richard's in his mid or late 80s. And I've asked him that question. And he worked closely with his father. And he said, you know, that was the thing about Harry. He was never afraid. And that may have happened after prison as well. I mean, when the worst thing you can imagine as a young man happens to you, perhaps that either breaks you or makes you a courageous, some would say, reckless activist.
Was he ever threatened?
Oh, constantly. Yeah, he had a whole repertoire of snappy answers for people who called him on the phone and threatened him and said awful things. And I think he was a little sad when that later in his life that stopped happening.
He published this and lived. He published his paper and lived in Elizabeth, the neighborhood Elizabeth, and not too far from 7th Street. And there is now a marker in that neighborhood that talks about where his house used to be, which is kind of an interesting thing because this is not he's not a Civil War hero. He's not a Revolutionary War hero, but he's an historical figure in this town.
That's right. And there's a wonderful group of people who have worked hard for many years in Charlotte to keep his memory alive and to remind people of, you know, what a strong figure he was. And you would have to look hard to find a more unlikely hero, but he was one.
From the 40s through the 50s, and I think maybe into the 60s, he wrote his newspaper. But then in 1958, as you mentioned, he published a book called Only in America. It became a surprise nationwide bestseller. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a collection of some of his, what he considered to be his best columns. What made it take off? What made it become so popular and catapult him into national fame?
Well, this is every author's secret
yes.
dream, of course.
And there was no Oprah publishing. Back then. Oprah didn't do this for him.
That's right. That's absolutely right. World Publishing, which was a good utility publisher of the time, published, I think, more dictionaries than anyone else in the world at one point, had a wonderful leader who quite visionary. And he contacted Golden and said, hey, how about a book? And Harry said, excellent idea, and responded by sending a cardboard box full of ratty newspaper clips in no particular order that reeked of cigar smoke and said, there you go, put it together, which they did. And they did very little advertising. No one expected it to sell, you know, remarkably well. And within a couple of days, it had sold 250,000 copies, which was just really unheard of at the time. You know, so much of this is an accident of timing, but it just hit a nerve. And apparently there was a time where you couldn't ride the New York subway without seeing half the car with that book open.
Hmm. Was he ready for the national stage? Did it unnerve him at all? Do you know? I mean, because suddenly he's in Edward R. Murrow wants to talk to him. He's on Jack Parr. He's on Johnny Carson. I mean, he's somebody called for a national column. He started writing that. Was he ready for that?
Well, here's where that healthy ego comes in. And he used to say, I'm glad this happened to me at 56, because if it had happened to me as a younger man, I wouldn't have been able to handle it. And I, too, was 56 when I finished this book last year, so I'm hoping that there's some good karma there on that number. But if he ever had any doubts about his fame or handling it, it certainly wasn't visible.
Wow. Harry Golden is the man we're talking about. He was a significant charlatan in the 40s through the late 70s. He died in 1981. Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett's biography of Harry Golden is called Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Made Us Care About Jews, the South, and Civil Rights. And we'll talk some more about Harry and also hear something else from Harry when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring the two-piece dinner combo, includes a leg and thigh fixins made from scratch buttermilk biscuit and drink, available all day at area Bojangles. Texas and Oklahoma have passed new laws that prevent local governments from banning hydraulic fracturing. Similar measures are being considered in three other states. And on the Diane Rehm Show today, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they're going to look at the debate over state efforts to regulate drilling. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you read Harry Golden, perhaps you knew Harry Golden, well, now's a good time to get on board with the conversation. You can email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back.
Charlotte Squawks returns to Booth Playhouse for its 11th edition. This musical parody takes aim at everything, from pop culture to politics to traffic and sports. WFAE is hosting an invited dress rehearsal on Thursday evening, June 4th at 8. Find out how you can join us for a sneak peek at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett, the biographer of Harry Golden, Carolina Israelite, how Harry Golden made us care about Jews, the South, and civil rights. Carolina Israelite, also the name of the newspaper that he wrote 4 years from Elizabeth here in Charlotte. And Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett will be appearing at the Lerner Hall at the Jewish Community Center on Sunday at 7 p.m. Information about that is on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. We just talked about Harry Golden's first book becoming a massive hit only in America. It was a collection of some of his favorite columns, and it just took off. It lighted a fire under people. What were those columns about? What was in those columns that so captured the imagination of readers around the country?
Well, it really was a collection of things. Some of them were historical, as only Golden could define history, and that might be how Dr. Samuel Johnson prepared oysters or Cato's cure for a hangover. Some of them were certainly about the race issues in the South. A lot of them, and these would be my favorites, I think, or sort of personal ruminations on the kind of random thoughts we all have, like, you know, don't get upset when the waitress brings you lima beans instead of green beans. And of course, I think the foundation of his popularity was he wrote extensively about the immigrant experience on the Lower East Side.
And that had people could relate to that no matter where they lived in the country?
Well, I think so, the way he did it. You know, he used to say we're all on the same ball of string that really – and this was part of – a great part of his appeal is that we are all different. We have different backgrounds, different influences, different nationalities. But when you come right down to it, we're all similar in so many ways. And he really played that tune quite a bit.
Other books would follow, and those other books would be almost as successful, more successful, equally successful. Where would you put them?
Well, that nothing ever matched that massive sales jump of that book. But he did have – he wrote more than 20 books.
Wow.
Five of them were bestsellers, two of them on the New York Times bestseller list at the same time. He wrote – the majority of them are these collected essays from the Carolina Israelite and other new essays. But he did write a couple that didn't fit into that. He wrote Forgotten Pioneer about – the early peddlers, which was a profession open to Jews in the early days of this country. He wrote about the Leo Frank trial, a book called A Little Girl is Dead.
That happened,
very famous lynching case.
Happened in Atlanta, and the Broadway musical Parade is about that incident.
Yep. And he wrote Mr. Kennedy and the Negroes, which was a book about the late President Kennedy, and which he had to finish up very quickly when the president was assassinated.
He had, as you mentioned, kept his conviction for fraud in New York relatively quiet down here. But when the book came out, as you said, an anonymous letter revealed his past. And rather than destroying him right from the gate, it actually helped book sales and the circulation of his paper. How do you explain that?
Well, it has been suggested to me by people close to me in my life that I should attempt to be arrested and sent to prison in order to boost sales. I am not willing to do that, I have to say. But, you know, America's a great place. We love our splashy stories and our showmen, and we love people who rise from the ashes of all kinds of disaster. And he also played that revelation quite well. He had a lot of friends in the media and a lot of celebrities who were sympathetic to him. And I think it really just has to do with the people's willingness to say, yeah, that was a big mistake. Now let's move on.
Well, that was then. This is now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He also wrote about the Jews and their precarious position across America and in the South. Was that – and you said that he embarrassed Jewish people sometimes. But was that writing welcomed by fellow Jews, or would they have preferred for him not to say anything and just let them keep their heads down, particularly in the South?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think at the time they certainly would have preferred he kept his mouth shut. During the 60s, you know, some of the listeners will remember this, there was a very famous declaration that came down from the Pope who said, you know, this we're revisiting this, you know, age-old slur that the Jews killed Jesus, and that's not true, and we're not going to say that anymore. And this was hailed by most Jewish leaders as real progress in Jewish-Christian relations, which it was. Now, Harry, on the other hand, said, well, fine, you know, we should all get together, we Jews, and forgive, you know, the Inquisition and all of these other sort of atrocities visited on Jews. And he just really embarrassed people by making fun of things that were sort of sacred cows. Mm-hmm. That said, when I interviewed people years ago when I first started this about Harry, almost everyone said, yes, he was an embarrassment. Yes, we wished he'd keep his mouth shut. But as one minister put it in a letter to him, you stood and enabled others in Dixie to stand. So they recognized his contribution and how important he was to the dialogue.
I know that Harry Golden was once asked after one of his speeches by someone in his Atlanta audience what a Jew was doing down here in the South trying to change the Southern way of life, to which he replied, I am trying to organize a Jewish society for the preservation of Christian ethics, and his Atlanta audience cheered him. Now, he spoke to a lot of Christian audiences, and you say that early on in his days on the Christian listener circuit, I think those are your words, he quickly learned what played well, and he repeated it in speech after speech. You have supplied us with an example of one story, evidently, that he told a lot.
My Presbyterian neighbors down there have acquired a kind of proprietary pride in me, you know. But I think it goes back to way in the beginning, in the early 1940s, I was invited to deliver a book review at the basement of one of the big churches. It was Christ Episcopal Church, the largest, most fashionable, and there must have been 400 or 500 of the leading citizens there. And I said, before I review my book, I'd like to tell you folks a secret. I hope you take it kindly. I said, you know, if Jesus were to include Charlotte, North Carolina, on his itinerary during the second coming, I'd be the first one he'd contact here. And they looked at me, first surprised and shocked a little bit. And I said, no, I'm not, no blasphemy. This is right. In the first place, I'm a cousin, a kinsman. And then he would need an interpreter. You don't suppose he talks this you all business? And then finally, he would need a trained reporter. He would want to know, he'd say, Harry, what are Episcopalians? And I could tell him. And the folks loved it, really. To this day, when they meet me on the street, say, hello, Harry, but there's a gleam in their eye. Say, don't forget me, boy.
He almost sounds like a Borscht Belt comedian.
He does. He really does. And it's interesting, he didn't actually play that circuit, the Borscht circuit in the Catskills, until quite late in his career. And part of that was he was just too controversial and he had really mixed feelings when he was finally asked to perform there. One, it was, I'm sure, you know, lucrative, and he enjoyed the large captive audience. But it was a little sad, too, because he wasn't quite as controversial by that point. Yeah. And that was a part of his decline.
Well, let's talk about that controversy, because most of that trouble probably came when he talked about racism. And he punched a hole, lots of holes, in the ridiculous societal mores and laws that kept segregation intact. He suggested at one point that because black nannies could only attend segregated theaters, movie theaters, in the company of white children, theaters should simply hand out white baby dolls to any African-American who wanted to see a movie. And he's also responsible for suggesting that we could easily integrate schools by simply removing all the chairs. Talk about the Golden Vertical Negro Plan.
Well, that was the first and most famous of several of these plans. And like many of Golden's best bits, he didn't actually make it up. He just capitalized on it. In fact, there was a small eatery in Charlotte that was well known for serving blacks and whites together because there were no chairs. And, you know, as you know, the way segregation was working at that time is no one really raised too much of a fuss if you were standing in line and mixing races. But the minute you started sitting down in school or in a restaurant or other public place, that was a problem. There was also over in Durham, the first Jewish mayor over there had essentially done this same removal of chairs business in a luncheonette in his department store. And Golden had a good eye for this stuff and made it his own.
So how did that function? When a man like Harry Golden writes and people read, we can solve this integrated school, this segregated school problem by simply taking out, leaving the desks, taking away the chairs. So everybody has to stand, and therefore there won't be any problem with that. Did that strike people as odd? Did it show them how ridiculous the laws were? Did it change minds?
Well, I think all of the above. And I think certainly there were people then and now who rail understandably against that kind of prejudice. But who would you rather listen to at the end of a long day? I think the fact that he could inject humor and say, boy, isn't this silly, carried a huge amount of power with it.
Is that how he got away with it? Because he injected humor into things. I think he once said that they don't hang people who make them laugh. Is that how he did it?
Well, I think so. And I think that he was right about that. I mean, even today, if you look at, you know, sort of our late night comedians and so forth, and how many people probably to a fault get their news coverage from that kind of entertainer. You know, they'll hear things, outrageous satire, that if someone sat them down and said these things in a very serious way, it would be much more offensive. It also helped that Golden was a short, stout, cigar-smoking Jewish guy who just looked and sounded, you know, you heard the clips, funny. And but some part of what he said would always, I think, lodge in people's brains, and it certainly made them question these behaviors that had become the norm.
Yeah, he said that no Southerner takes me, a Jew, a Yankee, and a radical, seriously. But what you're saying and what I'm hearing you say, and I think it's not an exaggeration, is that he was the Jon Stewart, the Stephen Colbert of his day.
I actually say that quite often, especially when I'm talking with younger people who want to know who he is. I say, well, Jon Stewart, only shorter, stouter, not quite as handsome. But yes, I really think that he was he kind of broke ground for all of these people who followed and who we rely on so much for news today.
Ashley on Twitter asks, what was Mr. Golden's opinion on organized labor's place in a just society? How did it mesh with the status quo at the time? Because as you point out, when he first arrived here in 1941, he wrote for a labor newspaper.
Well, he was very pro-labor. You know, he came out of the Lower East Side and worked as a very young man in the garment district. He often said he could have easily become a labor organizer. His, you know, probably, for lack of a better word, greed took him to Wall Street instead, where it took a lot of people at the time. He got a lot of humor out of the ambivalence or negative attitudes towards labor unions in the South. But he, above all, was a believer that working people should be paid a fair wage, and he considered people who helped that happen to be heroes.
You say that his great gift to his readers and to historians may be that through his writing we see quite clearly what many people did not know about race issues and religious and class differences. He wrote, you say, about African Americans as parents, workers, or students, in short, as people. It is too easy to forget the shameful truth that the concept of blacks as equals, or even as human beings, was a new idea for many of Golden's white readers. When you look back on what he wrote, how he wrote it, what would average people take away from that? What would we learn about our past that perhaps we don't know or understand today?
I think what we can take away is that as much as it sounds a bit like a cliche, one person really can make a difference, and that very small changes can have great power. People often asked Golden in Q&A sessions after his speeches, you know, what can I do about civil rights? I'm just one person. And he would always answer the same way. He would say, the next time someone uses a racial slur in front of you, put your hand on his arm and say, please, not in front of me. And I think that simple answer has great power, and that's a great starting point for all of us.
He also called him perhaps the world's first blogger. The internet was not here when he died in 1981. But the way he wrote, the short bursts in which he wrote, you compare to a blogger. What do you think he would have thought of the internet as a force in disseminating opinion had it been around when he was around? And would he be using it today as successfully as he used newsprint?
Well, I think he absolutely would have been using it because I think it's the best way to play the game. But I think he probably was happier, if I can project that, in a time when he was sort of a one-man machine, one-man internet.
Yeah, because that newspaper was pretty much all him, the Carolina
yes,
Israelite.
Was.
He wrote everything and the darn thing and I guess sold the ads for it, too.
Yes, he did.
Remembering Harry Golden, the book is called Carolina Israelite, How Harry Golden Makes Us Care About Jews, the South, and Civil Rights, by our guest today, Kimberly Marlowe Hartnett. Thank you very much for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And a reminder that Kimberly Hartnett will be in town at the Jewish Community Center in